Yes, I do.
Ms. Smith.
Could you please state your full name?
Michael Hennis.
And by whom are you employed?
I'm also employed by Minn Kota Power.
And so you are at the same business address as Mr. Chapin?
That's correct.
And what is your position with Minn Kota?
I'm the systems project manager for Minn Kota.
And could you just briefly discuss your education and your work history?
I received my Bachelor of Science degrees in Electrical Engineering and Engineering Management from the University of North Dakota. I began my career with Basin Electric in 1975. I then spent 2 years with the University of North Dakota involved in atmospheric science research efforts. I rejoined the power industry with Minn Kota in 1994 as an electrical engineer. I also have served as a project engineer and an engineering manager while at Minn Kota.
And what's your role with respect to the proposed project?
I am been assigned to the project manager for the Center to Grand Forks project.
And as project manager, what are your responsibilities?
Well, I have the overall responsibility for budgeting, scheduling, coordination of the permitting, the design, right-of-way acquisition, and construction of the proposed project.
And could you please tell the commission about the people or the groups of people that are assisting with this particular project?
Minn Kota, being a relatively small organization, has assigned team leads from various departments within the company. This includes engineering, environmental permitting, right-of-way legal, procurement, communications and public relations, and construction management. And because of our size of our corporation, we rely heavily on outside consultants for a project this size, and we've chosen Stanley Consultants as our prime consultant, who's responsible for the overall project design and the construction management phase as well. They in turn have subcontracted to Caterus, Lee and Jackson, and KBM, two local consulting firms that are assisting with the survey and the right-of-way acquisition components of this project. We've also retained the services of HDR engineers, and they're responsible for the overall environmental review and the permitting process.
And could you explain why Minn Kota is using outside personnel to assist with this particular project?
Yes, this is a normal practice for a project of this magnitude for a company our size. It's pretty impractical for us to staff up for such a large construction project. Minn Kota's normal capital construction budget is on the order of $5 to $10 million per year, and this particular project is a $300 million plus project.
And we have already admitted the application, so we'll go next to just a basic description of the project, if you could provide that to us.
This project, as stated earlier, is a 250-mile, 345 kV transmission line from Center, North Dakota, to Grand Forks, North Dakota. This project will also require modifications to our existing substations, both at Center and at Prairie, which is on the western edge of Grand Forks. The project also includes the installation of 4 fiber optic repeater stations along the route. These will be small huts located at the base of some of the transmission structures. We also will need to construct a new 230 kV tie line between the Square Butte substation, which is also located near the Center substation, and relocation of existing transmission structures at both the Center and Prairie substations. And as I stated earlier, the total estimated cost of this project is approximately $312 million.
And will the project be owned and operated by Minn Kota Power Cooperative?
Yes, that's correct.
And what is Minn Kota's anticipated schedule for the project?
Back in 2009, this project started out on a 4-year timeline. We identified the criticalness of adding additional load capability and the reliability issues for the winter of 2013 and 2014. Since we've been kind of moving towards a 5-year timeline, and this is now based on our anticipation of the PSC route permit this fall of 2011, and that would allow for a limited construction again this fall of 2011. We'd be able to mobilize a foundation contractor on a limited basis. This puts us with an in-service date of the third quarter of 2013, and we were previously planning for the end of 2012 construction.
And could you just explain why you're allowing approximately 2 years for construction of the project?
We are estimating progress on 8 miles a week. This translates to about 40 foundations or 40 structures per week. And this schedule does allow downtime in the heart of winter where it's difficult to work outside on a sustained basis. And also it limits construction when load restrictions are in place, and we feel this will help minimize road damage and soil compaction during construction.
And you testified that as project manager, you are involved with the permitting and design of the proposed project, is that right?
Yes.
And so as part of the permitting and design work, have you been involved in the siting process for the project, including the selection of the proposed project corridor?
Yes, I've been involved in all the aspects of the siting process.
And could you provide the commission with an overview of the siting process?
Well, the siting process for this project involves a four-step plan or approach. Steps one and two are part of the federal review process, and steps three and four are part of the state permitting process. I will use the exhibits to explain these steps in detail in a few minutes.
And why is the project undergoing a federal review?
As Minn Kota is requesting project funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, our Rural Utility Service, or I'll refer to it as RUS, to construct the project, a federal review process is required for loan approval. This process does include complying with the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA.
And before we discuss the exhibits, could you just explain how the use of the term corridor and route are used in those exhibits?
Yes, generally the term corridor implies a wider study area, while the term route implies a more narrower path considered for the proposed transmission line within that wider corridor. For example, on the Senator Grand Forks project in the federal process, Minn Kota first identified a 6-mile-wide study corridor and then selected 3 1,000-foot-wide routes within that corridor for further detailed analysis. For the state process, Minn Kota started with the identified preferred route in the federal process review and renamed it the Project Corridor. The Project Corridor will then be further analyzed in order to select the final location of the 150-foot-wide route that will be the basis for this project's route permit application to the PSC.
And how has the federal review process played a role in developing the corridor that's the subject of today's hearing?
Well, exhibits 4 through 8 help demonstrate this methodical narrowing process that took the project from a 6-mile-wide study corridor to a 1,000-foot-wide corridor, which corresponds with the four-step approach to the siting mentioned earlier. Steps 1 and 2, which are part of the federal review process, are shown in exhibits 4 through 7.
And could you describe for the commission step 1 of the siting process?
You know, step 1 was to prepare an alternative evaluation study, or also referred to as an AES, which was the basis for the earlier testimony by Mr. Chapin and Mr. Bartel. Now, this study identified the need for the project and reviewed several alternative solutions. A macro corridor study was also prepared in this step that identified the high-level environmental considerations in that 6-mile-wide corridor that would be common to any proposed route required to build the project. Exhibit 4 is the starting point, shows the constraints and challenges reviewed in the macro corridor study. At the time we introduced this to the public, we did solicit information to help us identify areas to avoid, such as private cemeteries, a center pivot irrigation, and private airstrips. This information was then added to the project maps to aid in the route selection. Exhibit 4 also shows the location of the existing transmission infrastructure that Mr. Bartel referred to. You know, selecting a corridor with as much geographic separation from the existing lines was a goal to maximize this reliability. In the exhibit, you can see the high density of transmission lines following the I-94 corridor from the Coalfield area to the Fargo area. And also on the northern part of the map, the top part of the map, you can identify this Ramsey Prairie line. So the natural location for our project from a reliability standpoint was to look at that corridor in the central part of the state, or roughly the Highway 200 corridor. This gave us the maximum geographic separation from the existing assets. Exhibit 5 shows the refinement in the macro corridor as a result of this public and agency input that was gathered. A northern Missouri River crossing was eliminated and shown in the gray, along with a southern route through the wing area. The more northern river crossing was eliminated due to agency and public concern about having a transmission line near the Cross Ranch facilities and property. There also was a strong sediment to locate the new transmission line within close proximity to the two existing transmission lines that do cross Missouri River, and that was the ultimate choice, was to locate the line between those two crossings. The more southern route through the wing area was identified as a area of high prairie potholes, wetlands, and severe technical challenges because of the size of some of those wetlands. Those wetlands would require spanning larger wetlands that are encountered in the other routes.
And what was step 2 of the siting process?
Step 2 was to prepare an environmental assessment with a scoping report. Now, the purpose of the environmental assessment is to identify routing alternatives within a study corridor and evaluate those alternatives to identify the route that presented the least overall impact for the entire 250-mile project. Exhibit 6 shows the approximately 191 routing segments that were reviewed in this process. Those routing segments were then screened down to 3 proposed routes, which are shown in Exhibit 7.
And how did Minn Kota then select the 1,000-foot wide corridor that is the subject of today's hearing?
Well, step 3 is the entry point into the PSC process, and the third step was to identify a corridor in which a transmission line route that will meet all the North Dakota PSC siting criteria can be located. The preferred 1,000-foot wide route identified in the environmental assessment process most fully met this criteria. That route has now been further refined with additional landowner input, and the result now is the 1,000-foot wide corridor presented in our corridor application and is also shown in Exhibit 8.
And then what will be step 4 of the siting process?
The fourth step in the siting process will be to identify the final alignment of the 150-foot wide route within this proposed corridor and submit this as our route permit application.
And then I direct you to what we've previously admitted as Exhibit 9. And referencing that exhibit, could you describe for the commission the public involvement opportunities that have been or will be provided as part of the siting process for this project?
Certainly. Public involvement and input has been a key priority for Minn Kota from the very beginning of this project. We hope to ensure an open and accessible corridor development and route siting process. Exhibit 9 provides an overview of the public participation opportunities during this corridor selection process. The chart is a timeline from the top down in 2009 to present, and the left side shows the participation by the public, opportunities available by Minn Kota's hosted meetings, as well as the regulatory process milestones on the right side of the chart. The yellow boxes indicate Minn Kota's sponsored outreach efforts. The blue boxes indicate the public input opportunities during the federal review process, and the green indicate public input opportunities that have occurred or will occur during the state process. Minn Kota has promoted this extensive and ongoing outreach by hosting nearly 20 public meetings since 2009. To these meetings, about 850 people attended, and we did receive well over 300 comments and addressed those comments. Most recently, numerous local public meetings for conditional use permits are also being held at the township and county levels. As a result of all these efforts, substantial public and stakeholder input has been collected and is considered and continues to be considering and developing the corridor. Other outreach tools that we've developed for these purposes include a project website, a toll-free information line, quarterly newsletters that we mail out to landowners identified along the proposed corridor, fact sheets, frequently asked questions, and a stakeholder database to track all the comments that come in on the project. Minn Kota is committed to ongoing communications throughout the permitting process, and this will also continue during the construction phase.
Could you explain how the public involvement opportunities that are depicted in Exhibit 9 correspond with the corridor selection process that you have described for us already?
As I stated earlier, Exhibit 9 does document the timeline that these public opportunities existed. The preliminary study corridors shown in Exhibit 4 were first introduced at the public-sponsored meetings in the spring of 2009. The refined macro corridors, as shown in Exhibit 5, were then introduced at the RUS scoping meeting as part of the federal process in the fall of 2009. The route segments and route segment alternatives to be analyzed in the environmental assessment, which are shown in Exhibit 6 and 7, were first presented at Minn Kota-sponsored public open house meetings in the spring of 2010. I'd like to point out that on Exhibit 5, the green stars do indicate the locations of those various public meetings during those time frames. The final proposed corridor, shown in Exhibit 8, was introduced during the winter of 2010 and 2011 as a preferred route identified in the environmental analysis. It was then publicized in our project newsletter, on the website, and in the corridor applications. Mr. Phillips will discuss this proposed corridor for this area in detail in his upcoming testimony.
And why is Minn Kota requesting approval of a 1,000-foot wide corridor for the project?
We feel by selecting the preferred route from the environmental assessment as a corridor for the corridor application for the PSC process, we can demonstrate that the proposed corridor has the least overall impact within the wider study area. The selection of this 1,000-foot wide project corridor is a result of an extensive pre-application routing process, and we feel provides the best opportunity for a more detailed analysis during state review. The macro corridor study to the environmental assessment process involved in-depth environmental analysis and multiple opportunities for agency, tribal, governmental review, and public input. This 1,000-foot wide project corridor is the same width utilized in the environmental assessment. Using a 6-mile wide corridor for the state process at this step in the project's development, in my opinion, would be a step backwards, because it ultimately would not answer the public's number one question asked, is where are you proposing to place the line? As such, a narrower corridor provides an opportunity for more meaningful public input. And a narrow corridor also minimizes the possibility of this corridor being utilized for other projects after the PSC approval. It is consistent also with the recommendations of the Commission in its letter response to Minn Kota's request for routing guidance early on in the project.
And what were some of the factors Minn Kota took into account in developing the proposed project corridor?
The two primary factors that we considered were to avoid occupied residences and to minimize impact to tillable croplands. Other factors that we considered in the corridor selection process include the avoiding of irrigated cropland, rural airports and airstrips, identified recreational, historical, archaeological, or other cultural significant areas when possible, and also avoiding potential disturbance to rare and endangered species of plants and animals. We also strove to minimize impacts to shelter belts, wooded areas, and other areas of conservation and ecological importance. We also strove to minimize effects on designated waterfall production areas, game management areas, and wildlife refuges, interference with extraction of economic minerals, and the engineering, construction, and maintenance hazard minimization were also considered. The evaluation also took in coordinating planning with existing wind easements, following existing rights-of-way, survey lines, natural division lines, and agricultural field boundaries when feasible. And also, a major evaluation factor was to enhance the electrical reliability of the transmission system and primarily adhering to North Dakota's Public Service Commission exclusion area and voidance area criteria.
And earlier you testified that as project manager, you oversee the right-of-way acquisition process. Is that right?
Yes.
What steps is Minn Kota taking to acquire right-of-way for the proposed project?
The project team is currently negotiating with landowners to obtain easement options for Minn Kota. Within the 1,000-foot wide corridor, Minn Kota will seek from landowners a 150-foot wide easement, often offered within a 500-foot wide easement option area.
And you mentioned that Minn Kota is obtaining easement options. What is the difference between an option and an easement?
An option is an agreement with the landowner for the future right to acquire a permanent easement. The right to acquire the easement must be then exercised within a specified time. An easement is a right granted by the landowner to use a specific piece of property for a specific use for a specified length of time.
And why is Minn Kota acquiring easement options as opposed to easements?
Acquiring options does allow Minn Kota to begin the right-of-way acquisition process at the same time it's pursuing the required permits. But this also helps limit Minn Kota's financial investment in case the permitting process necessitates a change in the right-of-way location. The 500-foot wide option gives the landowner and the right-of-way agent some limited flexibility in the ultimate alignment of 150-foot right-of-way. Requests can be made to the design team to review the exact location of the right-of-way placement.
And are the easements that will be obtained for the project limited to a specific purpose?
Yes, our easements allow Minn Kota Power to install and maintain a single transmission line system. No other purpose are included or allowed.
And how were easement payments determined?
The project took on a analysis to determine a land basis value for each county. This land basis value was calculated by compiling and comparing recent sales records for each county. And we also took into consideration the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service data, which is compiled and released on an annual basis also by county. This data tracks the land rental values and the land sales values across each state and on a county basis. We also considered impacts from other similar projects within the area. And compensation then is calculated for each landowner by a combination of this land basis value payment for the area of the easement. That would be the footprint of the overhead easement, 150-foot wide across the property, and also a per-structure payment. And that per-structure payment is based on the land use. A different payment is for cropland versus other non-tillable land activity. A compensation takes into account the current land usage, the local market value of the land, and the calculated acreage required for the right-of-way. Per-pole payments also take into consideration the effects on farming practices.
And then why aren't annual payments that are typically used for wind turbines being offered to landowners for this project?
We get asked about annual payments pretty regularly on this project, and our position is that the situations are quite different. In the case of wind farms, the developers and the landowners are working in combination to harvest a natural resource, in this case, the wind. The wind produces a profit-generating revenue stream. This is not the case with the transmission line. As a rural electric cooperative, Minn Kota's rates are based on the actual cost to deliver the electricity. We are not a profit-driven enterprise. While we take very seriously our obligation to provide fair compensation to landowners for easements, we also have an obligation to our ratepayers to keep electricity rates affordable. This means keeping our project development costs reasonable. It is important to note that at this time, no other transmission utility provider in the region make long-term yearly payments for transmission easements. We also like to note that having a transmission easement coexisting with a wind farm is entirely possible, as we've shown that by cooperating with existing wind easements across the proposed corridor.
And what activities will be restricted along the easement?
The restricted activities include placing permanent structures under the power line, planting of large growing trees within that 150-foot right-of-way, stockpiling materials under the line, which would minimize the clearance levels, or any activity that creates a safety hazard to the line operations.
And what impact on land use will the new transmission line have?
Well, we certainly recognize that a utility pole does create an inconvenience when placed on tillable ground. However, Minn Kota's selection of the steel monopole design minimizes impacts by allowing installation of poles without any guy wires and helps minimize the footprint of the project. In addition, a 1,000-foot spacing between these monopoles will help limit the impacts. Farm equipment does need to maneuver around the physical structures for seeding or harvesting, but again, with five structures per mile, we feel that this helps eliminate or minimize this impact. We also recognize an impact for aerial applicators, and they may need to modify their approach with the line on their property. We've talking with aerial applicators, and they say that it doesn't necessarily preclude the application, but it may change how they apply from the air.
And what compensation will landowners receive for disruption of land use during construction?
Besides the permanent easement payment, we also may need to negotiate temporary construction easements if we can't get access to that particular pole location along the easement. This would be an example of wetlands or forested areas. We may need to work through that. We also pay crop damage payments, and this is based on the first year's crop damage with the second year and a third and fourth follow-up year crop damage payments. We also make land damage payments to non-crop land. So if the landowner feels that our restoration does not meet their satisfaction, you know, we have opportunity, you know, to compensate for that as well. We also have reconstruction of fencing that may be damaged during construction, or the project does pay for the installation of gates along the right-of-way.
What are some of the benefits of the proposed project?
Well, we feel the primary benefits are this access to increased baseload generation to accommodate the future demand and load growth that our system is seeing, also the additional grid reliability that Mr. Bartel addressed. We also have long-term state and local tax payments that help fund community needs. These payments go to the school districts and the fire districts along the corridor. We also see projecting construction jobs from the project. The project will support approximately 200 to 250 specialized construction crews coming in to perform the foundation construction and the line construction. Of those 250 jobs, we project that 40 to 60 will more likely be local hire opportunities. And this may include the local supply of concrete and batch plant work, civil work for road construction and maintenance, the tree clearing contracts for the right-of-way, and also the fence construction prior to construction. We also see non-specialized labor for traffic control when necessary, and also the land restoration process after construction. We also see benefits from other construction stimulus to local economies, including expenditures for product and services such as hotels, restaurants, and fuel from local suppliers.
And based on the studies and analyses that Minn Kota has conducted and on the testimony that you have presented today, what are some of the conclusions Minn Kota has reached with respect to the proposed project?
Minn Kota feels that this project is the best possible solution for delivering additional baseload generation to Minn Kota service territory, and also the best solution for improving the reliability of the region's electrical network by solving this known voltage stability issue in the northern Red River Valley. Through the required federal review process, which included an in-depth environmental review and numerous opportunities for stakeholder and public input, Minn Kota has developed, in our opinion, a viable 1,000-foot wide corridor. The proposed corridor meets North Dakota's siting requirements and will result in the least overall impact of all the alternatives considered. In addition to providing additional baseload generation and grid reliability, the project will bring these local long-term economic benefits through the state and local tax payments and short-term stimulus through the construction jobs and those related expenditures.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Sagsby.
Just a couple questions. Mr. Hannes, so I apologize if I repeat myself from yesterday. The feds in the kind of step one analysis used the word route, and then as you got into your step three state analysis, that changed to corridor.
That's correct.
So with the permit application, I think that's exhibit three. You were involved in the RUS and the federal environmental analysis that's, I think, in Appendix D. Is that the environmental assessment?
Yes, as project manager, I help coordinate those efforts.
Okay, so you're familiar with the conclusions that the RUS came to in that analysis?
Yes.
And so I want to direct your attention to page 4-1. It's the preferred route selection where they talk about, it starts off by saying the deciding factors in selecting a route A as a preferred route are listed below.
Yes.
You have that in front of you?
Yes.
So at the bottom of that 4.0 paragraph where it says route A has about 33 segments, that basically means corridor A, correct? Because there is no route at that point.
In the federal process, it's still a route. The three routes in the environmental analysis are the narrower of those areas studied. So the term route applies for that federal process.
So, but it's 1,000 foot wide?
It's 1,000 foot wide.
Okay, so as used here, though, route A is 1,000 foot wide corridor.
It's 1,000 foot wide route in this document, but it's the same route that we renamed the corridor for the PSC process. Yes.
And so where it says, as Minn Kota negotiates easements and enters the state permitting process, there could be variations with the final route alignment. I take that to mean that the federal government acknowledges that there might be some shifting here and there.
That's correct, and they understand that through the state process, that and the landowner negotiation phase, that we may need to report back to them any major environmental impacts from changes. And basically, we catalog the changes throughout the project, and then we'll to wrap up the final environmental reporting to the RES. We will catalog any changes from the corridor that was part of their decision, so they're aware of that.
Okay, so the federal analysis that's done doesn't necessarily limit the final corridor.
No, that's correct.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Lehan?
No questions.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Call.
Thank you, Mike, for your testimony. I guess a question for you, but maybe for the council too, is yesterday we had some discussion towards the end about, we have an exhibit that talks about the public comments that came during the environmental impact period, if you will. Those are already in the record.
Yes.
But are you planning on submitting an exhibit in Washburn that talks about those stakeholder comments in the database that Mike talked about?
That particular database is not a public database. It's a private database. So the landowners or anyone that submitted comments wasn't necessarily submitting them as a public document. So that's one concern that we have with creating a new document that we would put into the public record. Anything that has been submitted to the agencies is provided and is in the filings. The others were, comments
okay.
that Minn Kota
received.
I'll
talk with our council, and then we'll figure that out in Washburn,
okay.
perhaps.
Sure.
And then just for you, I guess, sir.
Just one follow-up, sir.
Yeah.
We do have a summary of the topics of those comments that would be available, that basically gives you an indication of, what the topic subject is, that the number
of comments. Well, that would be helpful. Is that in anything you've already submitted?
No.
That would be good enough for me. I don't really need names, just general feelings of what some of the comments were.
Okay, we'll put together the topic comment, and we'll submit that this next week prior to Washburn.
Okay, thank you very much. And just one question for you, Mike. Tell me what you heard from the county commissioners in those meetings. Are there any general overall, you talked about county commissioner meetings, 11 counties. Was there a trend there that you heard or some?
Actually, all 11 of the county commissioner meetings were very well received. The big concern at the county level is the road maintenance and repair during construction. And we spent a lot of time at the commissioner level and at the township level going through our construction plan and our plan to also include what we call traffic maps or traffic plans. The project does plan to notify the public, where our staging areas are, which roads we'll be using during construction, and what time frame those roads will be used, as we progress along the line.
So do you have any quote written agreements with any of the county commissioners? Is it all just kind of verbal what you're going to do?
We are directed by some of the counties to get haul permits from their county engineer and county planning board.
Sure.
So at their request, we will transform this into a written plan, based on that. A lot of the conditional use permits that we're seeing also include language for working with the county engineer for assessing the road and a plan for repairing the roads during construction.
Okay, thank you very much.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Kramer.
Just one, as you were talking, and it's reflecting on yesterday as well, how many structures, somebody has an idea, how many structures are we talking about from start to finish?
Currently, it's just over 1,300, and the majority of them, about 1,240, are the tangent structures, and the 70-some structures are what we call running angle or corner structures, a little bigger structure requiring a little bigger foundation. That's about 2,000 truckloads of steel poles that will be coming into North Dakota and we anticipate, steel poles, our manufacturer has been secured and those poles will start arriving in the August timeframe.
How is the price of steel, by the way?
Well, we managed to negotiate a fixed firm contract for the delivery of 50 million pounds worth of steel just before the price went up. So the project is fortunate in our timing in making that contract.
What I'm thinking about and what I'm contemplating is the ramifications or consequences of the annual versus one-time payment for structure. And I'm just trying to get sense from a policy standpoint what that might mean. Anyway, but thank you for your testimony. That's all I have.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Cock.
I had one more that Kevin reminded me to ask. I know we've got a later witness that talks about it, but we had public input yesterday that there was a desire to even have more than the five-year pay period, if you will. Is there anything that says you can't go 10 years or 15 years right now? Because you've decided to go from one-time payment to 5 years. Why 5 years, not 10?
I think the five is a regulation by law that a right-of-way payment has to be considered as a one-time payment or can be spread out over five annual payments with interest.
What kind of law is that? I'm unaware of that.
I'll have to get you the exact citation, but there is a citation that does require that in statute.
Okay, so that's why you can't go past that five-year period. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions from the commission? Follow up, Ms. Smith.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Sagsveen.
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Lean.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hannes.
Refresh my recollection. What is Philip's testimony?
Yeah, okay. We are going to recess for lunch at this time. With my apologies, I don't like to recess at noon for lunch, but in the circumstances, that will be the best for us. Let's recess, please. Let's try and do lunch in 45 minutes and be back here at 12:45. And I will be here during the lunch break, and I'd be very happy to talk with anybody who has any questions about their testimony, or has or has exhibits to be marked, or if there's anything, any way that I can help you with your testimony, other, of course, than answering any specific questions about Minn Kota's project. I can't advise you regarding the project, but I can certainly help you with what you want the commission to know. So I'll be here during the noon hour, either before or after, whenever it suits you. So we'll be in recess until 12:45.